Hey there, everyone. Welcome back to the Behavioral Health Business Perspectives Podcast. I'm Chris Larson, Associate Editor for Behavioral Health Business. In this episode, I sit down with not one but two guests, Derek and Jessica Crane, the co-founders of Mindful Therapy Group. Derek is the company's CEO and Jessica is its COO. In this episode of the pod, we explore how Mindful Therapy Group scaled to over 2,300 providers while maintaining a 10% churn rate, the complexities of the Professional Corporation Management Services Organization Business Model, or PCMSO model, the rise of clinical quality demands by insurance plans, future expansion plans, and the potential integration of AI into mental health care without sacrificing the essential human connection. Before we get to that conversation, I just wanted to let you know that Behavioral Health Business has a lot of in-person and digital events lined up for 2026. If you're interested in joining the conversation, just let us know. Okay, on to the interview. Hey there, Derek and Jessica. Thank you so much for joining the pod.
Thanks for having us. Appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, appreciate you. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Okay, so regular BHB Perspective listeners will know that we normally do one-on-one interviews. We've only had a few two-guest conversations, and I think this is the first time that we've had a married couple on the show. So I have to ask, what is it like owning and managing a business with your spouse?
It's a question we get a lot, to be honest with you. It's not every day that you see, you know, co-founders and also the key leaders of the company as a married couple. And I'd say a lot of people, you know, they have their doubts that it can work, but I think it's actually great. We have the advantage of using our very different brains. I'm, you know, more of the creative problem solver, operational brain. Derek's the visionary. He's the growth guy. He pushes things forward in that way. So, you know, if you really look at, you know, having two sides of a coin, I really think that's us. And, you know, we feel blessed to be able to work with each other each day. And also we get to solve problems, you know, maybe in places and situations that other people wouldn't have the opportunity to, which kind of opens up some different opportunities. Like, you know, when you're out for a walk and you're in nature, it gets your brain in a different place, in a more collaborative place. Or sometimes we're really stressed out and, you know, we'll have the ability to go like sit in the sauna and work out a problem. So I don't know. I think it works really well for us. And we still like each other, which is, I think, the important thing.
And there's times, you know, it comes with, it comes with conflict at times. And, you know, you have to be honest with yourself and set good boundaries when you don't want to bring business into your home, but we're pretty good at setting those boundaries when we need to. And for me, I think it's all about sort of letting go of your ego and letting the person around you who's good at something do what they're good at and you do what you're good at.
Yeah, creating space for the other person and their brain to go where it needs to go.
I gotcha. Now, one of the things I wanted to help our listeners understand at the beginning of the conversation is, you know, just a little bit more about your business and your guys' role in them. So let's go ahead and start by highlighting the two specific organizations that you lead. If anybody looks you up online, they'll recognize, you know, two different entities that are under a similar Mindful brand. So can you guys lay out what are those organizations? What do they do? And how are they related and how are you related to them?
Yeah, great question. Sometimes I wonder if it makes sense for them to both be, you know, out there publicly, but, you know, we're really one brand. Mindful Therapy Group's the brand. It's our collective group of providers. That's master's levels therapists, psychologists, psychiatric prescribers. And they function together under that Mindful Therapy Group umbrella. They're independent providers within a supportive structure. If anyone is familiar with the PCMSO model, that's what kind of makes up the PC, where we hold all of our clinical pieces, policies and procedures, compliance, insurance contracts, and also our relationships with the providers. And then Mindful Support Services is our MSO. So that's known as a management services organization. It's kind of just the back end services that make the company run. They really go hand in hand. One doesn't really operate without the other, but I think from a, you know, how do you explain it to potential provider or the outside world? It's, you know, what enables the therapist to really focus on the clinical pieces is a well-oiled machine on the back end. they're super interconnected. And maybe one day we'll decide the public doesn't really need to see how the sausage is made, but it was a decision we made several years ago, and it does help, you know, providers understand how the business is structured, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that definitely does make sense. So when did y'all found these organizations? And today, do you still own and run both of these?
So we founded the company in 2011. Derek is a licensed clinical social worker and was in private practice at that time. I was working as a nurse, and we had our first kid, and you know, we were grinding. Derek was working 40 hours a week. I was helping kind of support some of the back end pieces of his private practice, and the phone wouldn't stop ringing. He was, you know, really sought after. And we thought, let's bring on some more providers. So it started like any other small group practice does. You see a need for more supply than you have demand, and you build it. You know, Derek had a waiting list. He was, you know, unable to meet the need. So we started with a few providers, and we learned a lot of hard lessons really early on. It took us a while to get it, you know, to the point where we felt really confident in continuing to grow it. You know, we had a little practice in Mount Lake Terrace for, you know, the first year, but then the second year we were taking a wall down. Then the next year we were taking another wall down. And before you know it, we had a full floor in this, you know, suburban market here in Washington. And about 5 years in or 4 years in, we opened our second location. That was in the Northgate, kind of North Seattle area. And we were building confidence. I think that's, you know, what we learned early was that we were good leaders and that Derek's clinical expertise was flowing out into this group of providers that we had built.
We were failing and learning every day. And that failure and sort of, you know, being resilient with that failure gave us more and more confidence to continue to grow.
And I was really good at sort of the operational and the scaling side. And so we continued to add more brick and mortar locations until 2020, obviously. We had built kind of the pièce de résistance, as they say, down in Elliott Bay, which is in the old Seattle PI building. It's got a view of the Puget Sound and the Olympic Mountains and 10,000 square feet, 27 private offices. And we opened that in March of 2020. I think it was 8 days before lockdown. And that's just, you know, when the world changed, when our model changed. And really, actually, I mean, in that moment, it felt like the world was ending.
We were crying. We were all huddled up in a room together. Is this going to end? Is the company going to end? Are we going to end?
Yeah, a lot of people felt that way.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, as you know, telehealth changed the entire industry, and we had a really great team that enabled us to pivot and build our telehealth practice and continue to expand, both in brick and mortar and telehealth over the next several years, which is where we're at now.
What really prepared us was that 2018 snowstorm that we had in Seattle that got us prepared for telehealth, because we knew when at that time, all those appointments that we had brick and mortar, all the patients had to go home and we lost revenue. So we knew that we had to prepare for telehealth. So we started working on telehealth before, you know, COVID hit. And so when COVID hit, we were prepared for that transition of, you know, at that time, we transitioned 4,000 clients that were brick and mortar clients in the clinics to telehealth, and it worked successfully.
Yeah, it's remarkable where, you know, lessons for running a better business come from. Sometimes the weather, you know, hands it to you. And then sometimes, you know, global pandemics will put your organization on a different track. And strangely enough, I think a lot of outpatient mental health companies are the better for it, because at that time, so many people were shown that there is incredible value in seeking out help from people who can help them live well in their own minds. One quick follow-up. Where is the organization at today in terms of like its scale? How many therapists are engaged in the model? What kind of numbers are we looking at in terms of like market served or locations? However you guys think about that.
Yeah, so we're in 5 markets currently. Our biggest market is Washington, and then next is Oregon. We started in Oregon in 2021. And then in 2024, we added Arizona, Colorado, and Nevada. We're currently working with over 2,300 providers across those markets. The biggest proportion of them, obviously, is serving Washington. And we're seeing about 31,000 visits per week. It's hard to scale it another way. That's just the way that we think about visits, is just how much volume you're doing on a weekly basis. I would just say, like, you know, we're seeing tremendous growth in those new markets, but Oregon actually has been really great to see, because we're able to see, you know, what it looks like to have an expansion market then become a mature market, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does.
And one of the things that I think that differentiates us from other companies is that we grow slowly and methodically. You know, there's always that temptation, do you go hang your shingle out in 50 states? And we don't think that model works. So I feel like, you know, you can get watered down that way. And you want to grow sustainably. You want to grow where your providers are able to get patients and they can grow sustainably.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, yeah. I think we have, you know, done the legwork to be able to expand into 20 new markets if we wanted to. But I think for me, my value is in being able to build something that I'm proud of and that providers are excited about being a part of. And I really want to matter in the markets that we're in.
And when COVID hit, there was this big shift from companies to purely do, you know, online platforms or online, you know, telehealth. And we created that, you know, but we always stuck to putting money into the clinics, investing into the brick and mortar locations, whatever stage you go into.
It builds community. It enables, you know, providers to have flexibility to be able to, you know, work collaboratively with other providers in office and, you know, be hybrid at home when they want to. And it's the best of both worlds for patients too. Seeing a huge amount of demand for in-person services. So, you know, I think we opened 7 new brick and mortar offices this year. We have plans to do that at same scale next year.
In our call center where we have, you know, over 70 people working, we'll get 5,000 calls a week, and 90% of them will be requesting a brick and mortar location for a patient to actually come into.
So, real quick, let's go ahead and switch gears a little bit. This is the perfect time of year to think about the year that was, the year that's ahead. But let's go ahead and start this part of the conversation by talking about the year that was in 2025. So what was your business's most significant accomplishment this year?
I think our most significant accomplishment was going into Nevada, Arizona, and Colorado, into competitive markets. And going in there with paucity, being a little bit scared, like, is this going to work? Is this going to be as good as Washington and Oregon? And really finding success, you know, starting out slow, understanding the market, assessing, you know, what the providers need, and eventually finding success. And, you know, now in, you know, Colorado, we're seeing over 1,000 clients a week. In Arizona, the same. So really finding success and showing that we can be reliable and successful in different markets.
And I think for me, I think, you know, what we've done a really good job of this year is growing our team. We've added a lot of really smart people. We stood up a brand new clinical quality and compliance group. We brought in some amazing key leaders who are pushing us forward in the areas of technology, data infrastructure, and finance. We hired a new CFO this year, a new controller. You know, we're building a data mart and, you know, whole data infrastructure product line that can, you know, bring in data from all the different sources so that we can understand, you know, what's working, what's not working, and make faster pivots when running the company, which I think is really key. And then also, not only did we bring those people in, but they're all really bought in. They're bought into the mission. And they're really keyed in on making the business better. So I'm really proud of that.
So what would you say then was the biggest battle y'all had to fight in 2025?
I think for me, it's been about trying to educate and bring along over 2,000 providers on change management. You know, there's a lot of headwinds in mental health right now, which, you know, is kind of new for us, you know, having run the company for over 14 years. We've really experienced nothing but tailwinds all the way up until really this year. And that's, you know, in the areas of payer pressure, rates are stagnant, we're facing increased audits and scrutiny from payers as the industry's gotten more attention, which has forced us to have to change the way we're leading the company and focusing more on compliance, higher quality documentation, investing, you know, time and tech in order to meet those demands. And that just creates a lot of change management. And when you get to this scale, it gets a lot harder. Providers don't like change, and they like to do things the way that they like to do them and be really clinically focused. And I think that's great. And I think in the past that worked. You know, I know we're going to talk about, you know, some technology, you know, opportunities in mental health. One of the things we're experiencing is that the payers are also upping their game in the technology space, right, and on the data side. And you have to be ready to step to it. And bringing providers along, I'd say, has been the biggest challenge this year. They don't have all the same visibility that we have, you know, because we sort of run interference on, you know, what the payers are asking for. And, you know, that relieves a lot of stress for providers. But on the other side, they don't have all this, all the insight into, you know, what needs to get better and stronger on the quality side. So, you know, we have to lead that.
I think there was a paradigm shift, you know, prior to COVID. You go back 10 years, 15 years ago, nobody cared what therapists were doing. COVID hits and you have all these different mental health companies in the game. There's all these transactions, you know, but therapy is about dollars now and the payers care. And then payers want to see, you know, what they're paying for. And they're not all bad. You know, they want to see that, that the patient has a strong therapeutic alliance, you know, with their therapist. And we want to be able to show them that they do.
Yeah. I think our providers are doing amazing work. It's a paradigm shift though, that they now have to really demonstrate that in a really clear way in order to keep getting paid.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that we've seen a lot across our coverage in behavioral health business. I work also a lot on the autism therapy front. So the focus is very much, at least from the payer side, on ensuring quality, making sure, like as you guys said, they understand what's being paid for, because the rate at which ABA is being administered throughout the United States has just gone up astronomically over the last, I'll call it the last 10 years or so, especially in the last five. And when these payers are paying a lot more money for something that they really didn't pay a lot of money for back in the day, they start to ask questions. It kind of seems to be the pattern of things, as it were. So I wanted to shift gears a little bit and talk just a little bit more about the year that was. So how did 2025 defy your expectations, at least as far as the business is concerned?
Oh my gosh, I'll take that one. I think, you know, when we decided that we were going to grow pretty heavily in 2025, we brought on over 500 providers. I thought that we might, you know, sort of like when you grow, when you scale, you're going to lose that mom and pop feel. You're going to lose that good service. What surprised me is that, you know, we were able to maintain that stickiness with providers and that our churn rate is only 10% in 25. So we're only churning, losing 10% of providers. Which to me is unbelievable. I think the national average is around 25, given that we grew so much. So I'm really proud of that fact that we could scale and grow and still have, you know, strong provider satisfaction.
Awesome. So let's look to the future now. So what is your number one goal to have accomplished by the end of 2026?
I think for me, you know, we're expanding in Texas. I really want to take the time to learn that market, understand that market, and be successful in it. Texas feels like a country. It feels really big. So to really to navigate it and do it well. And also, I'm really proud of the fact that for the first time, we'll be taking Medicaid in Washington. We haven't taken Medicaid here ever because it's been very, very kind of hard mountain to climb. But taking Medicaid in Oregon, taking Medicaid in Colorado really gave us the confidence to start working on building the infrastructure here in Washington, which there's a lot of different things we had to overcome to even get in and take Medicaid. But if we can be successful with Medicaid in 2026 in Washington, that would be great.
I think for me, we have a lot of technology goals we set around our data infrastructure project, measurement-based care and compliance that we're trying to accomplish next year. It goes back to that meeting the need that payers are putting us through in terms of being able to prove quality. My goal is to get that buttoned up and a data infrastructure that can then report out on it so that we can continue to negotiate, market rates, high paying rates with payers, and continue to set ourselves apart as, a provider-centric company who's focused on clinical quality and is running a tight ship.
So let's actually zero in a little bit more on working with payers. At present, so much of behavioral health is defined by changes in government policy regarding reimbursement or the change in relationship with other third-party payers. And it's no secret that it's challenging to work in network. Recently, we had the APA Provider Pulse Survey come out, and that shows that 75% of psychologists, at least, that aren't in network already say that they're out because of low reimbursement. I mean, 75% is a huge number of any group to agree on, let alone clinicians. Clinicians all have very different approaches to any number of topics. But when you get 3/4 of a specific group saying that the number one reason that they're not doing a thing is because of this thing, it's notable. So what does the payer dynamic look like for your organization? And how do you think that's going to change in 2026?
I think a lot of providers resist working with insurance. It is incredibly difficult to navigate, especially if you're, hanging a single shingle, as they say, trying to navigate it on your own and manage your clinical practice. And I think that's where our model is really beneficial to providers because we're navigating that on the behalf of over 2,000 providers, putting systems in place so that we can, meet their requirements and continue to negotiate higher reimbursement rates. I mean, I think our rates, for our providers are, roughly 20 to 30% higher than what, somebody out there on their own can get. And that's because we're able to provide quick access. We're, managing the compliance pieces and the, credentialing, delegation, all those things. So we're providing a value to payers by, helping providers be compliant and able to, demonstrate quality. I think all of those things really play in our favor. But I don't see a world in which we don't rely mostly on, commercial payers. And, I think we're less than 2% government payers at this point. Because that's how you create real access for patients. It's sad to me that so many providers opt out of taking insurance because Americans can't afford mental health care to pay out of pocket. That's just not the reality of the economy at this point. And, that's really important to us is to be able to fill that gap and provide real access to care.
And even when they can, they mm-hmm. don't want to. I remember romanticizing, being a therapist and romanticizing private pay and charging a high rate at one point. And, I had a couple patients that lasted a couple sessions because they don't want to pay it. They want to utilize their insurance. So we've accepted that we're going to be working with payers, but what we do is we get in there and we meet with them every week. We see what we need to work on. We ask for things from them. So we like to look at it as a partnership and working together to provide good care and good access for patients.
I gotcha. And a lot of the frustrations of being a mental health clinician in this day and age, comes from working with insurance, but there's any number of things that really complicate being a clinician in this day and age. I mean, honestly, it's never been more complicated. There have never been tougher forces. So how do you guys keep clinicians connected to the mission of mental health care at Mindful?
I think that's a really good question. I think it's always keeping the therapist at the forefront of your mind. You know, we like to call ourselves a provider-centric company. You know, I think if you take care of the provider, it naturally flows down to the patient. I remember working in hospitals and, you know, nurses burning themselves out and getting urinary tract infections because they went for hours without peeing. And they were always just kind of focused on the patient. And they had this mentality of like sacrificing and over-sacrificing and over-tolerating. And what happens is eventually these people burn out. And therapists, they have a quick burnout rate too. So if you don't put them on the forefront, they need good pay. You can't have a therapist where you have some companies that are pressuring them to work 30 and 40 hours and then they get this particular bonus. No, as a therapist, maybe you're doing 20, 18 hours a week. You need good, you know, hours, reasonable hours. You need good work-life balance. And you need to know that as a leader and as running a company that you need to prioritize your therapists. And then it's easier for them to focus on the mission and focus on doing the things that they're good at, which is providing good clinical care.
Okay. So we've already touched on it a couple of times. So let's really zero in on the technology questions that we have. Starting with artificial intelligence, it seems like I can't get out of literally any conversation these days without having mentioned, heard, or touching on AI. So for Mindful, what role, if any, does it play at the organization today, and how do you anticipate that changing in the near future?
I mean, AI is relatively new in business and particularly, in mental health care. I really look at it as a, you know, way to support efficiency and operations. Right now we're using it for compliance. We have an AI audit tool that we're using to assess for quality documentation and, the matching documentation up with coding, which is super important for, working with payers. We're also building some AI bots in some of our workflows just to streamline, you know, efficiencies on real manual tasks, which, you know, I think our employees are thankful for. I also just see it as a awesome tool to be able to use it for patient matching. So that's something we're developing where you can, you know, have patients, you know, enter in their complaints and what they're looking for and have that match up a little bit more organically to what the provider is looking for as well. I'm hopeful that can create some better fits, you know, over, you know, checking a specialty box, which is what we have right now. So those are the ways that I think it can really help us on our side. In terms of how the providers use it, like currently, they, you know, have the opportunity to use AI scribes if they want to. And our EHR doesn't have that built in a very native way yet. And when it does, I think that'll still be kind of an opt-in. There is a lot of reticence we're seeing from providers to use AI in their practice. There's a lot of fear around it. And so we're just trying to be really respectful and kind of let them take the lead a little bit in terms of how they want to include that in their practice from a, you know, diagnosing perspective or ambient listening and clinical documentation. Those are ways that I think it could be really helpful to, you know, reduce burnout and time spent on documentation. If I were a therapist in the chair, I would use it. We use AI every day, at the leadership level and, with everyone on our management team uses it in all kinds of ways. It's, super helpful for pushing our ideas forward, coming up with, you know, different strategies, analyzing documentation or contracts, all those kinds of ways. It's super helpful. But I think from, the patient-client relationship, we're treading very lightly.
I think as a therapist, you know, we take for granted how hard it is to sit in that chair and listen to these traumatic stories and, you know, some of the vicarious trauma that you take on and you have to internalize. And then when you think about AI, I think about how I used to be as a therapist and I always procrastinated with my charting, and a lot of our therapists do as well. And I see AI, like if I go back, I would love to use AI to really help me be able to, you know, be efficient with my charting so that I can take that time with that patient that already drains me.
Yeah. And no matter what, therapists are not going to be able to escape, at least facing AI as a factor in mental health. I mean, already generative artificial intelligence is, like, specifically the chatbots out there, are used by millions that are looking for some kind of mental health support. There's actually, you know, of course, you can't get online and look around and not see a headline about some questionable, you know, use of these general use chatbots when it comes to mental health. And there's some really, like, remarkably horrifying stories about potential harms that are real and happening in people's lives because they're using these kind of tools when they're looking for some kind of mental health support. So how do you think outpatient mental health providers should navigate this specific issue, patients using these tools, like when they're not in the therapist's office?
I think, you know, that question is very, very complex. I think, you know, it reminds me of me when I was working in the hospitals in the early 2000s. And, you know, I had a lot of doctor friends and they always complain about how the patients would call in and or text in or email about using WebMD and coming up with their own diagnosis. You know, you want to be transparent with your patients, and you want to, you know, be real, that understand that they're looking for that support, right? They're looking for that emotional support, but to also take things with a grain of salt and use it, you know, wisely. I think when I think about patients, we were down at the behavioral health conference down in San Diego, and all the AI talk, they were talking about how many people search AI. And what I think they're really looking for is just support and information where they're not going to be judged. So the biggest thing is that people don't want to feel shame. They don't want to be judged. On the other side, therapists are worried that bots are going to replace them. And I don't think they are. The big learning here, because I don't think you could ever replace the intuition of a therapist, the experience of a therapist. But the big learning from, you know, people doing all this bot research is that their patients don't want to be judged. So we need to start looking at really providing supportive frameworks and environments for their patients, because that's the biggest fear out there for patients, is they don't want to be judged and they want to be supported.
Yeah, I think it's putting guardrails, you know, into the technology itself. I think there's a lot of, you know, talk around that. But, you know, to add to what Derek said, you know, AI is new and it's shiny and people are just looking for somebody to listen to them. You know, there are other platforms out there that, you know, offer what's like text therapy and things like that. We've never really bought into that concept because we feel like it's a boundary issue between the therapist and the patient. But what happens in the in-between? You know, you see your therapist, you know, one time a week, and maybe you haven't built those coping skills yet to get to the next week. And how can, you know, there be some supportive technology built in that, you know, is that listening ear for folks in the in-between? And I see that as, you know, a supportive solution. And, you know, it, with the proper guardrails and design and bringing therapists in to really build those kind of models, I could see it working in that way. But I mean, the missing link is human connection. People are feeling lonely. And the AI, you know, tools, they'll never replace that. You'll still, you know, finish your chat session and feel lonely because there wasn't a human on the other side. So that's how I see it. I mean, that's, you know, personal opinion. Take it with a grain of salt.
So you all started Mindful in 2011, 14 years ago. Do you see yourself as CEO and COO in, say, 3 years from now?
I do. Yeah, I still feel like, you know, we're young. I still feel like I still feel passionate about providing mental health care access to patients, and passionate about our mission. I still enjoy working with our team, and I continue to want to grow slowly and methodically. I still don't want to be in 50 states in 3 years. And, you know, I could see ourselves being in maybe 3 to 5, but I still really enjoy this work at the end of the day.
Yeah. I think for me, like what gets me up in the morning is, you know, all that creative problem solving. The problems get harder and heavier as you scale. And those are, you know, those are the challenges I think we're facing now. But, you know, if you continue to bring more support and, you know, smart people around you, it continues to still be doable and exciting to solve those problems, you know, in furthering the mission. I think what we learn as we continue to travel around the country and meet with providers is in every market we've gone into, including, you know, now entering into Texas and also entering into Minnesota this coming year, providers are excited for us to be there. Our model's different and it's supportive, and we're focused on, you know, that sustainable growth so that as we continue to grow, providers are able to build a, you know, a real private practice and make a real living with Mindful. It doesn't, you don't need to be on 10 different platforms in order to, you know, fill a caseload. And we're going to continue to stick to that mission and build in a thoughtful way over the next several years. I still feel energized by that too.
Derek, Jessica, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate your time today.
Really appreciate you.
Thank you so much for listening to our latest episode of the Behavioral Health Business Perspectives Podcast. I'm Chris Larson, Associate Editor for Behavioral Health Business, a part of the WTWH Media family of businesses. We'll catch you next time.